Welcome back to episode 311. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Did you see the Trump mugshot?
I did. I thought it looked great.
It's a great campaign photo, right?
Sure, absolutely. And no, in fact, I think we're going to see that picture quite often going forward here.
It's an iconic shot, I guess, one of the you know, go down with, like, I don't know, with the moon landing, I guess the Afghan chick.
Yeah, I
National
actually,
Geographic, and I don't
you know, if I had to like look for a parallel, I was kind of thinking of Jack Nicholson in The Shining, was sort of similar, you know, and that Donald is looking up, you know, he's angry and he's staring up, you know, which is always the right way to, you know, represent kind of like angry energy, you know. So it's often used by cinematographers, you know, to create that image. So he came across looking very pugnacious, ready to fight, and I think that's going to that picture will represent that in the campaign.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of it, really, of the whole thing, because it's such a show. You'd think if he really just wanted to back out, he'd make a deal. Hey, I'm not going to run, and they'd back off. For some reason, they seem intent on going on with the show with these four indictments. I mean, obviously, these clowns in Atlanta, New York, these are just you know, low IQ functionaries. The federal case is a whole other matter. The federal cases, rather, I think. But there are two at the federal level, two at the state level, or if I,
yeah.
Right. So, you know, it's just, of course, we had the debates, the GOP debates, and there was, yeah, I think came across as sort of like a Jerry Springer show.
It was a Jerry Springer show. I mean, you know, the fact is he can actually be convicted and still be president.
Yes, Eugene Debs was in prison in 1920 when he ran and received, I think, 700,000 votes, the Socialist Party. He'd been in prison for just questioning the America's entry into World War One. I think violating, was it the Sedition Acts, I guess, that had been passed for. So yeah, it's weird, because if he were convicted, I think Secret Service had to go to prison with him.
I just don't see any way this cannot be a chapter from the clown world. It just, So here's a scenario. He's convicted. He's imprisoned. He wins the presidency. And then in a redo of January 6th, his followers storm the prison and break him out. And then get him to Washington, where he pardons himself.
Yeah. As far as the debate goes, I guess the best performance was Vivek Wisheshwamy, right? What did you say? I mean,
sure,
as far as
absolutely.
He's the most clear-minded, I think. I mean,
I really like him. Yeah.
I mean, he's a civic nationalist. He's talking about American values. He's apparently an entrepreneur. I think it was a pharmaceutical industry or biotech or something, which is interesting. But he's a good speaker. I mean, he seems to be probably the best performance of that night. I saw a meme that American Democracy 2023, two Indians fighting over aid to Israel. There was Vivek versus Nikki Haley, former governor of California. I'm sorry, South Carolina. And it's funny how people, the parent in Israel is just over the top now. Was it Isa Hutchinson who had like a Israeli lapel pin on or something?
Yeah.
So he's not running for prime minister or president of Israel. He's running for president of the United States, right? But we all know you have to go through Israel for that, I guess. So.
Yeah, the Republicans have this tendency to have these group clusters that become hysterical in their support of Israel. I remember Christie. It was, I'm not sure, maybe two cycles ago, but he actually became hysterical. And, you know, there had been some threats to Israel from one of the Arab neighbors. And Christie was screaming, you know, they come my election, you won't have to put up with this anymore. And it was like he was actually going to get there and man the anti-aircraft guns. This is all theater. They're just doing this to, mind control the public into accepting a kind of slavish relationship, right? Where the politicians have more allegiance, more emotion for Israel than for the United States. We saw that during the Netanyahu address to Congress, right? The like 500 standing ovations. And you don't need to go to these kinds of levels to make the point. We like Israel, we support it. They do these things as part of mind control, right? They're just trying to make sure that the public knows that Israel is not the 51st state, it's the first state, and no criticism of it is permitted. And so there's intimidation that is generated by these slavish Israel, pom-pom parties, where everyone is just outdoing one another for their to the extreme degree they support the, a foreign country.
Yeah, I think a few governors actually flown to Israel to sign laws, either suppressing free
DeSantis.
DeSantis, who's of course running, he flew to Israel to sign a law suppressing controlling speech, apparently. And then there was another governor, I think, he flew there to sign another anti-BDS law or something. And I think more than half the states have laws either restricting or banning BDS activity, meaning in order to go to school or receive a government contract or be employed by the state, you have to swear not to take part in BDS activity. That's the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement to penalize or Israel for its human rights violations
Yeah, and
vis-a-vis
I
Palestinians.
have a question. I don't understand these restrictions because BDS is such a broad term. I mean, who defines that?
I know. And who would think, how does that law get proposed and slipped into a bill and voted
Yeah,
on? It's
I
like,
mean, I just it just seems totally incoherent because
yeah.
I mean, if you even like say, well, gee, I really like Palestinians and I hope they do well in the future, is that a violation? I mean, the laws are. They're just so broad. I think they function more just as intimidation. It's just more of the, Holocaust denial narrative, where people are afraid to even talk about these things because there's just so much arrayed psychological structure against them.
Yeah, Vivek Ramaswamy actually came out and criticized aid to Israel,
Yeah.
calling, and of course that he caught the I guess the wrath of the neocons and also of the military industrial complex and all that, because he's some of his rhetoric is he's sort of like running as sort of a Ron Paul type candidate this time around.
Yeah, I think that the
So
neocons.
someone said instead of Ron Paul, it's Ron Patel. I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
That was pretty funny.
I think the neocons could be in for some exposure and kind of diminution of support because the Ukrainian war is just, which is their baby,
Yeah.
obviously. It's just absolutely collapsing. You can see now everything we discussed a year and a half ago is coming about. The nation is being just genocided. There's no hope. They're starting to abandon even the fantasy about some sort of breakthrough. And of course they've expended all of the troops. And so when Russia comes in, which I'm sure they will eventually, there'll be no real resistance. So they will have accidentally, of course, that's they always do things accidentally. They will have completely liquidated Ukraine as a nation, and then whatever's left is just a kind of neutral zone and a BlackRock economic enterprise.
Yeah, and I think Vivek he should come out and say he'll name like Colonel McGregor his national security advisor.
Yeah,
You know,
that would be
drive the
great.
Kagans insane.
Yeah, that would. That would.
So, well, clown world, here we are. Yeah, here we are. How do we get here? Well, I think if we, I think today we I suggest that today we do kind of a retrospective of the year. Annus Terribilis, I guess you could say, 1965. A lot happened in that year that I think determine the course of the country. First thing, of course, was, I think it was in January of 1965, you had Lyndon Johnson come out and give his Great Society speech at the State of the Union. I think it was the first televised State of the Union address. Prior to that, it was, these things weren't televised, from what I recall. And he called for a great society, and proposing a whole heap of legislation, social programs, spending, to create this great society. And this sort of set the tone for the rest of the decade, and leave the next. Well, here we are, almost 60 years later. A lot of, Higher Education Act, the Secondary and Primary Education Act, a whole host of, entitlement programs, welfare programs, aid programs, block grants, and these things, just a boondoggle, one boondoggle after another, as it turned out. So that's when I think of 1965. You also, a part of that was also the Moynihan Report. We can talk about this. A series of other legislations, like the Voting Rights Act, to address some of the civil rights issues. The year prior, you had the, of course, the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964 passed. But then immediately in that summer, you had things like the Watts riots and all the race riots break out. And supposedly, in this era of reform, things were going so much better. You had these riots break out as a result of a drunk driver being pulled over and not cooperating. Gee, we've ever heard that before? So that's what's your take on this year, 1965? I wasn't in the world yet. You were born. You were a teenager. So
Man,
let's.
I was there, Tim. I can report about it from a firsthand perspective. And as you say, the Great Society program was probably the most powerful destructive element that the year produced. If you look at all of the legislations that have, come out of this program, basically, they're all destructive. Some of them just massively destructive. All of the demographics that they were trying to address got worse. And the proponents for it, and there are some for the Great Society laws, they will say, well, poverty went down, but they don't actually mention that earned income went way down. And what was actually getting rid of poverty was just this increase in welfare benefits, which of course paralyzed the community, right? Because then you don't have the relationship to employment, and of course, if you're not married, you get more benefits if you're a mom. So they just demolished the family in the inner city. But the thing about 65 that, at least in my life, and I think actually for the culture of the country in general, was just that's really when the counterculture got rolling. It was 65, and I remember it very well. I mean, 64, you just didn't have LSD and kind of degenerate music. You had the Motown and the Beach Boys, things like this. But in 65, you started getting, you had the Beatles who were earlier, but they were incrementally risque, but they were still kind of on the side of, you could bring them home to your parents and they, you didn't expect them to
I
take
think they were
drugs.
still wearing suits at this point when they're
Yeah, they're
concerts.
wearing suits, and this is how they
And
introduced us to culture. But then,
the hair was just below
just below, yeah, the forehead,
the
right? So you can see how organized this all was. But they spawned the Rolling Stones, and now the Rolling Stones come, and they are, more sexual in their, certainly Jagger's dancing. They have longer hair. They're more, avant-garde counterculture,
Yeah,
and they're spawned.
they're uglier.
Yeah, they're uglier, and they their songs are more risque. I mean, 1965 is when I Can't Get No Satisfaction. It was a, an overtly sexual description of, of Jagger's condition.
Wasn't Jagger trained at the London School of Economics?
Yeah, he
Yeah,
was, and in
yeah.
fact, the Rolling Stones, as has been documented, were funded by the London School of Economics, which of course is an annex of the Rothschild family. The Rothschild family member was on the board during the time when purportedly the Rolling Stones were funded as a project. And looking back on all this, it's you know, all of these things become transparent. And
1965. It also, that's when Bob Dylan goes electric, which created quite a stir at the
Bob
time.
Dylan goes electric, and also
Yeah,
Laurel
yeah.
Canyon starts to all of these, you know,
The birds, yeah.
people who have background in military intelligence, Frank Zappa, Jim Morris, and Dave Crosby, they all show up in 65. And so you start getting this the scene on the Sunset Strip with long hair and drugs. And then up north, and I really kind of think that there's this really important loci of the counterculture. There are many, many things. I mean, the Beatles, the Stones, you know, all this. But I really think that at least in California, which was an avant-garde of the counterculture, it was with the acid tests, and they began in 65, where you would have the merry prankster, and remember that expression is Masonic, right? The merry prankster is a character from the Middle Ages who, you know, it goes around and is basically destructive to culture. So anyway, the merry pranksters put on their first acid test in I think it was in November of 65, and you know you had to pay a buck, but they had LSD there, all the LSD you could drink. And the important thing is they also had like Stuart Brand, remember him, the Whole Earth Catalog, but he was one of the inventors of the personal computer, right? So you're getting to see the whole picture here. And he would give lectures on the Native American culture. Okay, so think about the rock and roll guys who are wearing cowboy and Indian outfits. You know, this is the archaic revival idea. So you're taking LSD. Brand is giving these slideshows on how great it is to be a Native American, trying to pull kids out of their culture and retrograde them into more primitive ideas. And Allen Ginsberg was there, and he would just chant these incoherent mantras. I mean, we've talked about the function of mysticism, you know, as it breaks down the rational thinking. And of course, when you're on LSD and you have Ginsberg chanting mantras, well, I guess you're about as far from reason as a human can get. And then you have to remember, at the acid tests, the Warlocks were playing. You know, these were the Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
And of course, as we've discussed, the Grateful Dead are 100% Masonic.
Weren't they in Watts during the riots?
They came down for the riots, indeed.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
These things are structured. And when you look at the acid test and just stand back from it and look at how it, you know, all of these individuals end up influencing our culture. I mean, Tim, to me, this is just 100% an aspect of the authoritarian personality. You know, I mean, this is just when they talk about using Eros and propaganda to control the minds of the population. Well, here you go. And they've even got their LSD drug, which they've been developing, you know, in the MK Ultra context for like 15 years. So this is what happened in 65. They changed the music, they changed the influencers, you know. So instead of the Beach Boys, you know, kind of normal looking individuals, you end up with the Rolling Stones. You know, you're getting told that you have to change everything about your culture, and sexuality is moving toward pornography, drugs are replacing religion, right? And it's all there's a soundtrack. And this is, you know, the Grateful Dead, Bob Dylan, Rolling Stones. And all of this as a package is moving the baby boomer that I was part of into, you know, not just accepting the counterculture, but becoming proponents of it. You know, where my generation was just let off a cliff.
Yeah, that's year you have we did a show a couple of years ago back about 4 or 5 years about the Moynihan Report, which
Yeah.
was of course a report submitted by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, I think, who was an employee at the he was the serving as a, I think, Assistant Secretary of Labor under President Johnson. And
I
this was
believe
part
that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah, and so this is a report about the official report was the Negro Family, the Case for National Action. And at that time, Moynihan had to notice sort of a the pathology in the black community. At the time, the illegitimacy rate was an astonishing 25%.
Wow.
I think that's just below the national average for everybody in the United States today. I think it's close to 80% today for blacks. But this was seen as a crisis. And the report was based on the work of a black sociologist, E. Franklin Frazier, who had done some work in the 30s, who had observed that blacks who maintained family cohesion tended to fare much better than blacks who didn't do it. And Moynihan incorporated this work into the report and proposed a series of action plans or programs to address this crisis. And one was a labor or works jobs program for black males specifically to promote family cohesion, particularly with fathers at home. Of course, as you alluded to, other programs within the Great Society would weaken that, providing basically aid for family with dependent care and other welfare programs, public housing being dependent on a woman being single, therefore marginalizing the black male. But this plan was highly criticized at the time because it was, quote, blaming the victim, and also it was sexist. So it was going against the spirit of the age and was pretty much rejected in favor of, I guess you could say, contraception, abortion, and welfare. And of course, we see the bitter fruits of that today with the, like anything, these were becoming a problem in the 60s, especially in the urban areas with black crime. You mentioned the Watts riots, where basically it was excused as they called it a rebellion. We heard that in 1992 in LA. We hear it in 2020 with George Floyd riots. But basically, these are just excuses or pretexts to loot, rob, murder, and burn and destroy things. But the response in the 1960s was to more programs like the Kerner Commission a few years later to deal with. I think that was a response to the 67, 68 riots and also 65 riots. But again, these plan the Moynihan Report was rejected more or less, and no real effort was made to encourage family cohesion or unity in the black community. In fact, everything was done to destroy it. So whatever problems that existed within the black community, and there were many, they were highly exasperated or increased with the intrusion of the federal government into these things. That also was sort of the civil rights era. The narrative of the civil rights era was that all the problems were a result of white racism and not pathological black behavior or problems. So if you pointed that out, higher rates of violence, domestic abuse, alcohol addiction, drug abuse, and these things, crime, you were blaming the victims. So the problem was never really dealt with. And also with the civil rights movement, you had the cult of integration, which in the ensuing years would try to force whites to live with blacks, do away with things like covenant law. That was done back in the 1940s. But you had the big push for racial integration in the late 60s and 70s with busing and all those Supreme Court decisions. So yeah, it was almost you had the civil, it's what you see now is today's with Black Lives Matter and also with the critical race theory. These things have been weaponized to go after, basically white Americans, to go after the majority of America, to render it much more docile. And perhaps destroy it.
Of
So.
course. Well, I just want a little thought experiment. If we had taken Moynihan's advice and the out of wedlock births in the African American communities were currently was 10% instead of 85%, we would be the happiest country in history. I mean, that's how dramatic it is. The violence would be that low because the violence which is associated to such a large extent with young black males, if you looked at the statistics, in 1965, you could see Moynihan's point is that, well, this is by a large degree it's coming from kids who are coming from broken homes, right? So if we had gone the other direction, if we had created social programs that would have promoted families and had been successful to some extent, reduced it by half, you would have right now basically the workers' paradise. There's just no question about it. There have been, so much money has been spent and wasted on projects inside the inner city to, end poverty. And you now have a situation where there is no end to poverty that's even possible. I was in Los Angeles a while ago, and you'll never change the fentanyl brigade. I mean, the homeless communities there, they just are not, they're not capable really of any way of being fixed. So, you look at that, and what I'm saying is just self-evident. You wondered, well, how in the world was it that we didn't change direction? I mean, what kept us with these destructive social programs that began in 65 when we were moving away from the goal, which was to have a healthy and prosperous inner city and African American community? Well, I'm afraid the only answer is just it's because what that's what they wanted. These are deliberate programs. There's really no other explanation. Everything else is frankly, I just think it's just too weak for consideration. So they took the African American community off a cliff, and then they wanted to stuff all of the rest of American culture into it. That's the
Yeah, I
world.
mean, yeah, it's a it's a lumpen proletariat, if you will. Like they can mobilize, which you've seen, create black terror if you want. You can create a black, and you spin a narrative like George Floyd, like it's done for justice when they're just stealing stuff, stealing crap, and these looting. And we're seeing it now with the breakdown of the city's law and order, without even prosecuting shoplifters. And but with the Great Society, all the money that's transferred, the trillions that have been spent, people have just studied it. The primary beneficiaries of the Great Society were actually middle class doctors, teachers, bureaucrats, social workers, construction companies, bankers, who provided federally subsidized goods and services for these programs. And that explains partially why the programs persist and grow, because they create a constituency that's very powerful. Public housing is a huge scam. Public housing units that are built at three, four times the cost of renovating existing housing stock, improving it. And so basically, the Great Society, again, that coupled, of course, with the military industrial complex, which was exploding at the same time with the war in Vietnam and the Cold War, created sort of an insatiable Leviathan state that the federal government became in the 1960s. And something like the Civil Rights Act and the problems in the South became a pretext for even more expanded federal oversight and control, as the way the media spun the problems in the South is simply a symbol of Southern primitivism and backwardness that only the Yankees could improve with their oversight and intervention. And so there's no stopping it, and just, it was like the floodgates had been poured open, so, which is why by now we had now it created perennial federal budget deficits, which is why they had to close the gold window in the early 70s, because they couldn't deal with any pretext for redemption at that point, which was supposedly created by the Bretton Woods system. The financial the government became so poor by the end of the decade.
Yeah, you can't run a gigantic welfare state unless you're on fiat currency. It's impossible because the people will start to redeem the obviously threatened currency because they're going to be more of a produce by exchanging it for gold, which is what was going on. I mean, they were just taking all the gold out of the United States, and so they had to stop it. They either had to stop creating debt, which they didn't want to do, or stop transferring it for gold. And so we ended up with the current situation. We have the fiat dollar, which is just a psychological condition. And the government now is ever expanding, and it claims it must, otherwise there'll be I mean the racism or whatever they claim. But that's why it's really kind of useful. Everyone should really do this exercise and go back to 65 and actually look at the conditions of the United States at that time.
You also had exploding roles of federal government education. I mentioned the Secondary and Primary Education Act, which began this stream of federal funding into local schools, which a lot of strings attached with that, and also at the Higher Education Act, which again built upon the GI Bill to fund the expansion of the colleges, universities throughout the country. At a very time, of course, when the Frankfurt School was the cultural Marxist,
Yeah.
would greatly benefit from this. Of course, you had this huge, huge, I guess, a cohort of young people going to college, then being gradually indoctrinated because of the culture Marxists that are benefiting from the Higher Education Act. Of course, this group is very nepotistic, and so they made sure they benefited primarily from all the money going into the education system, particularly university system, which then just exploded the price of education because you have more money chasing it. So universities expanded
I mean,
and
the
tuition went up.
university, it was just one of the areas that they took control of, one of the institutions that they made the long march through. And the educational apparatus became narrower and narrower every year. I mean, think of what is, able to be discussed at the universities now as opposed to 1965. So you're getting a single note, single political party, which doesn't begin to describe it because it's just a very small fraction. It's basically, if you don't adhere to strict cultural Marxism, you can't teach at a university at this point, or you'll be, castigated and you're struggling all the time. And there are some exceptions to this, but, in general, not. And the cultural Marxism that we are basically, being damaged by, yeah, it's certainly, a good point to look at it is the authoritarian personality. But one thing I do need to mention is that the Frankfurt School controlled the authoritarian personality. So, we look at the American Jewish Committee and we think, well, this is where this is actually starting. No, it goes all the way back to the Frankfurt School. I mean, the F scale, incidentally, the F scale, the fascism scale, the pseudo-psychological way of like describing Gentiles who want to have any kind of political power as potential fascism, that was actually developed by the Frankfurt School. It wasn't they brought it to the authoritarian personality. And that's important because the Frankfurt School is directly related to the Hungarian Soviet, Gregor Luchas. We talk about this guy all the time. And so you can see that this is a pre-Holocaust, pre-World War II plan to take culture exactly where we have been taken, with the destruction of the family, the promotion of every imaginable kind of sexuality, and of course, an ever-expanding central authority, which needs no participation, from the citizen. It's a kind of a dictatorship. So, I mean, what can you say? 65 was when the attack on kind of European culture really accelerated. I mean, I would, parallel it with like 9/11, being when the deep state comes out, and suddenly you've got all of these ways of having real overt control over the population. I mean, this was in 65 was when they started to take cultural control over the population.
Yeah, you have that 65 year, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is passed in August of that year, and of course this was supposedly done in accordance with the 14th and 15th Amendments passed, the century before or after the Civil War, in order to protect the voting rights of the newly emancipated slaves. But nevertheless, in the ensuing years, certain restrictions were imposed with Jim Crow, restrictions in the polls like literacy tests, poll taxes, which restricted the vote, particularly down south for blacks. But then we had this, but this act, right, sounds good. What it was an invitation for mass voter fraud we have today, of course, but particularly how votes are collected among blacks, because it's just ballot harvesting in many ways, where at churches and stuff where people are registered, then the votes are cast for them. And there's no real accurate test of how many of those votes actually are done on there, which is technically illegal, but because if you do that, you're racist. But now we've gotten to the point where the Voting Rights Act is done to justify the gerrymandering to create minority districts, because it's presumed that blacks will vote for blacks, and therefore they have to have districts have to be manipulated in a way that ensures that blacks elect black representatives, which isn't really in the law, but that's how the courts interpret it. Also, someone interpret the Voting Rights Act, if you pass a law requiring voter ID, it's considered voter intimidation. You have to vote, in order to buy a pack of cigarettes or to buy some alcohol. you have to present an ID, but to vote, apparently you don't have to. Of course, we saw what happened in 2020 with mail-in voting. The sloppier and the more people vote, the better, because it's easier to cheat. And it was just how elections are held now today. It's just the sloppiest affair, which benefits. Elections have always been, like I said, we've talked about this before, election fraud is always elections. But this kind of opened the floodgates because it created a racial angle. And also this idea in democracy in general is the more people vote, the better. We're basically just a race to the bottom at this point, especially as you're diluting the quality of the population, which they've done, of course, not only with education. Also the idea that just people voting matters when there's so much more to voting in terms of like self-government and just simply showing up and voting or mailing in a vote for people, for God's sake. It's being informed, it's being engaged. And of course, at this time, the media even then was highly controlled with the press, with CIA's Mockingbird media and the media, the networks and the radio is controlled by a very narrow group of people, of a particular ethnic group. And so the flow of information and the propaganda. So again, when they talk about democracy, now the people, the defenders of our democracy are now arresting political opponents like Donald Trump and his lawyers. It's hard to take them serious that they defend democracy when they're resorting to things like that. But again, it's sort of a race to the bottom, mass democracy, mass culture, mass entertainment, so they can be easily manipulated. So it's, again, the idea that you can just open the floodgates, let more people vote. That's going to create quality in government, a better, more representative, responsive government. Well, the past 60 years obviously indicates otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, this was always the plan. The clump, by which I mean the American voters, is mindless. I mean, you've got all of these immigrants that have come in over the last 10 years. They're all going to vote, and who's going to say no to them?
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot of inner city voters that are obviously not informed of anything other than race, right? And so that's kind of your majority, because they can manipulate those two groups. I mean, they did it in the last election to get Biden in. And so the quality of democracy is basically zero. The informed people who have kind of an understanding of the world that is nuanced, I mean, they don't have any political power, because they don't really have a chance to have a meaningful majority or close to majority in the federal elections. Molly Ball kind of
yep.
talked about this in her article about how they can simply manipulate the unwashed, the unlearned, into creating the majority for the candidate that.
No, now they're protecting us from misinformation. They're protecting us from misinformation.
Of course, they're they have our interests at heart, and so a very small group now is able to control the country using the illusion of democracy as their bona fides. They can say, well, you don't like democracy, good heavens, but in fact, they manipulate the media, and then now they even manipulate the ballots. So,
well, right now they're claiming to challenge election results is a criminal. It's a RICO conspiracy act to do that. Pretty
sure.
Soon to vote for another party would be considered undermining an election.
The last election was so
yeah.
Weak. It was really, in my opinion, pretty close to a third world dictatorship kind of thing. It was just, there was so much weird stuff that was just shown after the election results were presented that wasn't investigated.
Mm-hmm.
And then ended up, where the 1-6 protesters were arrested and, Trump is accused of election fraud because he was, kind of contesting it. That's a third world sort of situation where a dictatorship, in this case, the cultural Marxists, right, are in a position now where they are uncontested. You cannot really, through the ballot box, get them out. They have just taken over the apparatus of the federal government and the election process. So the response has to be to try to figure out, well, how can you have any kind of political power in your world? And obviously, you got to look local for that.
Yeah, you mentioned, of course, the 1965 with Obviously, the move towards even greater mass democracy with more people voting. At the same time, the erosion or the dilution or the decrease in the quality stock of the country, the people actually voting. And of course, 1965 featured the Hart-Celler Act. Or it's, the Hart-Celler Immigration Act was signed into law by Lyndon Johnson on October 3rd, 1965, at the foot of the Statue of Liberty. The piece of legislation was drafted, of course, by the by Jewish Jewish congressional representative of New York named Emanuel Seller, and this piece of legislation was supported by Senate by non-Jewish but very liberal senator named Philip Hart from Michigan. But the bill was backed by every known Jewish organization at the time, so there was a lot of money and media support behind it. The B'nai B'rith, the Anti-Defamation League, American Jewish Committee supported it. Of course, in the run-up to this, you had the B'nai B'rith had John F. Kennedy. At least they put his John F. Kennedy's name on it. A Nation of Immigrants, from what I understand, it was actually written by a guy named Meyer Feldman. Apparently, it was ghostwritten by Meyer Feldman, and they put John F. Kennedy's name on it to create this idea that the United States is indeed a nation of immigrants. Basically, what the law did was it changed the quota, and it repealed, or effectively repealed, the 1924 Immigration Act. And for the first time, United States was going to do away with the quota system. Up until then, there was a priority on immigrants from Europe, particularly Northern Europe, coming into the country. They had a lot of problems, in the preceding 40 years, United States, with immigrants now coming from Southern Europe, particularly, and also the, of course, the Jews coming in from the Pale of Settlement in the 1890s. So there was a by after after the World War I, there was people were kind of fed up. Said we've absorbed a lot of people. We need time to digest this, and it worked pretty well for the for the better part of 40 years. There was a very tight immigration into the United States. But then the floodgates were open in 1965. It was kind of gradual at the time, at least the demographic effects. I think at the time, the United States closed at a 90% ethnic white majority. And Lyndon Johnson and even Ted Kennedy, who put his name on the bill, said it would not change the demographics of the country. Of course, they were lying. It did. And now we're seeing the effects of this. But again, it's interesting, again, and we've talked in other shows. The key role that Jewish support paid for this played in passing of this law, and the objectives indeed the Jewish groups like the ADL and B'nai B'rith came out actively in support of it to change the demographics of the country, saying, "Don't worry, it won't matter. If it won't matter, then why do it?"
I mean, we talked about kind of the origin of B'nai B'rith a few shows ago. It's a gangster organization. And just I'll just say that it's that's if you look at its background, it's a branch of Freemasonry, and it was involved in the production of the Civil War, and it played both sides of the street, at least people involved with it. Edwin de Leon and these guys. I mean, they both promoted slavery, and then on the other side, they worked against it whenever it was, to their benefit, because then you ended up with the Schiff family, who was involved in the production of slavery, then, marching with Martin Luther King, 40, 50, 60 years later. So, there are no real principles that are in play here that I can see other than just self-interest. That's B'nai B'rith, and then you look at the American Jewish Committee. Well, they were somehow able to swallow the Frankfurt School, right? They just they brought it and the F scale over Adorno and Horkheimer, and this is another just gangster organization. I mean, these guys are the descendants of the Hungarian Soviet that the Christian Hungarians had to overthrow. Tried to execute all of them and declared them enemies of the state. So you look at this power in the United States that is involved in controlling our elections, and it's not hard to understand sort of both the moral and kind of ethnic structure that you're dealing with here. It's pretty self-evident. So Again, it's we're at a situation now, we're at a point now where you can't, these things are clear enough, I believe, certainly in independent media, most of these facts are available to the public, but it's hard for people to discuss them because they're, the different structures, certainly the charge of being anti-Semitic is powerful. Holocaust denial is powerful. And just to digress, I'm kind of curious and looking forward to E. Michael Jones' book, which may be released in the next week, entitled The Holocaust Narrative. I'm curious as to his take on all of that to see if, to what extent he can clarify that situation. Maybe we can talk about it later. But, you when you it's funny how you start looking at something like 1965. And it's not hard when you try to understand really the power structure of what's changing and what's moving and where you're headed. You get right into the same groups, Tim, that you do if look at almost any cultural phenomenon in the last 50 years.
Yeah, they say, of course, the changing demographics, the browning of America, would inevitably lead to a changing of America's culture and politics. Well, then they're admitting that there are profound issues or questions regarding demographics and the self-interest or the self or the survival of the native population. And if you flood it, of course, if you open the floodgates, you not only do you increase legal immigration from the third world, or you also stop enforcing, or you also essentially permit illegal immigration and flooding the country. You create sanctuary cities, and there's all types of organizations, NGOs that are involved in going to various cities like New York and Chicago and LA to declare themselves sanctuary cities. And then all of a sudden they have a migrant crisis. They stop calling them illegal aliens. They'll stop calling them migrants if you're just walking around. No, they're flooding the country, and they're being flown from all the four corners of the world. You have people from Sudan migrating via
I
the
lost
Mexican
you,
border.
Tim.
Yeah, as far as the sanctuary cities and these cities that are like L New York and Los Angeles and Chicago. Well, this is all the work of like various NGOs that are encouraging this, and we see this internationally too, like also in Europe, where of course with these Jewish organizations like the Hebrew Immigration Aid Society, HIAS, are supporting this in Europe. Pretty much every ethnic white country is being flooded with non-whites, so it's not just a one country. And so it's a strategy. And of course, U.S. Department of Homeland Security is headed by Alejandro Mayorkas, who's Jewish, who has had a complete stand down at the border in violation of his oath of office. And they're not enforcing the laws. And really, someone should be, the Congress should impeach him, and he should be brought up on charges because it's for dereliction of duty and also treason, I think.
Of course. I mean, the thing is, the protection of the border is absolutely fundamental to protection of the Constitution. We have all of the descriptions of citizens in our local regulations and in the Constitution. And so obviously it's illegal to not have a border, and you don't really have any kind of a country without such a thing. So of course that is the correct response. But no one is even talking about that. The Republicans, I mean, obviously they're a controlled opposition, in my opinion, the ones who have access to the media, because they're so weak on this issue. They would, say things like, I mean, basically DeSantis shipped them illegal immigrants to New York. Well, that's clever, but why doesn't he ship them back to the country they came from?
Yeah, I understand the stunt, but
Yeah.
it doesn't address. I mean,
Right. It's
I
political
like to see
theater,
Martha's
but.
Vineyard people, the hypocrisy of people at Martha's Vineyard, but nevertheless, the solution isn't to, like up in New York, where you have New York's trying to ship them up in upstate New York, and they have local counties rejecting it. And same thing, Chicago, where Brandon Johnson floated the idea of sharing some of the migrants that have enriched Chicago with their sanctuary city status into the white suburbs. So they can maintain Chicago to continue being a sanctuary city. It's like, are you kidding me? It doesn't solve the doesn't solve the problem. But again, when you have a president who He's not in control of it. He's senile, but he a few years ago he was a videotape saying that we're seeing an unrelenting stream of non-whites into the country, and it's a good thing. And America was soon to be a majority non-white country, and that's a good thing. So there's a strategy here. There is an objective, a goal, which they openly talk about. But then if you point it out to them, you're considered a racist. Although you're going back to 1965. When pr the politicians who signed that law promised that it would not change the country's demographics, and it obviously has. I think in 2019, white children became a minority of America's school children, ethnic whites. So it's baked into the cake now because of this immigration policy, both illegal and illegal. And I do think the illegal immigration is just secret policy, so.
Well, and the other half of that is they've been able to affect abortion and birth control into European populations. Talking about the population bomb, the baby boomer, all of these negative ideas about family, and then of course just the modern version of feminism that they have produced, makes Europeans not at replicant level, right? And then at the same time, the immigration. Well, there is no policy. They can just come in and it's to the extent that they want. So, we're headed for extreme minority position. We're already there politically.
Yeah, it's anti-natalist demoralization
And
and
you mentioned the Chicago mayor with his idea of moving the immigrants out to the suburbs. Well, there is a perfect example of the kind of things that we've been talking about. Obviously the suburbs are going to be popular because Chicago is descending into, not even third world status. I mean, just into barbarism. I mean, there are people shot at the baseball game yesterday, at Comiskey Park. So it's descending into barbarism. So the suburbs will be more popular. But if someone like that is able to through a maneuver to get the immigrants to be stuffed into these communities, he will. So the only way you can resist it is with really strong political leadership. And that means you're going to have to go there as far as race and protection of community, because there's just no other way at this point. I mean, if you're looking 30, 40 years out, these areas will be as blighted as the inside of Chicago if you just let them roll out to you and you don't stop them. So America is resegregating. It's kind of interesting, because part of this is just the COVID online platform, right? Where people now are more and more working online. I think that's a trend that's just going to continue, and so they can live where they want. Well, people don't want to live in the inner cities, and more that's the case. So, the exodus from the inner cities is rapid. I mean, it's amazing when you look at the videos of San Francisco, of just no businesses available, nothing on the street. The retail street business has just collapsed. So they're really, the cities just don't have a future. But the people who are leaving are obviously, well, they're better organized mentally. I'm sure there's a large majority white and Asian. Certainly black technical intellectuals are part of the exodus. Latinos, same thing. But where they end up in these enclaves, like in San Francisco, they might try Marin. Mendocino is a little far out, but certainly like Santa Rosa, the cities that are just on the outside. But how are you going to defend these enclaves if you don't have political power? You lost control of San Francisco, because these groups, wanted to change the racial demographics of the city. They wanted to, create barbarism, and they have had that through various techniques. Now they have won, but the force isn't going to stop there. They're going to come right at you after you've resegregated by moving out to some suburb or some little enclave town. So you've just got to, energize your political mojo and try to come together. The right response to all this is not yet happening. I mean, there's some of it which a lot of it came about of the good stuff that has happened come out from the vaccine resistance. But there really has to be a kind of a recreation of aggressive, confident, and knowledgeable European political power, right? It just we have to try to recreate it out in these enclaves and these suburbs that people are heading to. I've had some encouraging comments. I know people who are in Seattle that have moved out to the Olympia Peninsula have said that the small towns out there are really benefiting from the immigration and also are aware of what, there is a kind of an awareness of what caused it, certainly of the political decadence, inside these major cities. So this is the struggle of our time. It's
Well,
to
Americans are still low, particularly white Americans are still very hesitant to speak in terms of ethnicity or race because that was always considered, well, racist. That's another term, racist, when that term was coined. But that, of course, it was all well and good when you're 85% of the population and you can indulge this stuff. But as you become a minority and a plurality of minority, it becomes more of an issue that you can't avoid. And it's particularly when you're denied any agency or identity because you're an ethnic white, whereas everyone else is allowed to identify as such and mobilize those principles. And you mentioned, of course, sort of the population, the decline of native birth rates. 1965 also marked, I think, the coining of the term sexism. But I think it's credited to Pauline M. Lett. Note the last name. The student faculty forum at Franklin and Marshall College. Basically, this was the term of sexism. Of course, we heard isms like racism and sexism and these things. This pathologizes sort of the acknowledgement that men and women are different and complementary. That became sexist. And I think there was an idea of sexism was the idea that you discriminated against women when sex wasn't a factor. Of course, the question goes, when is sex never not a factor?
Tell me
It's
the
like,
time.
whoa, that's a it's a whole chunk of life where sex is always there, and it's a reality. Of course, now we're being told that sex doesn't really exist. You can identify as such, you can change it, you can morph into something else after being mutilated and taking cross-sex hormone treatments and these things. And also, you mentioned also this 1965 also was the year of the Supreme Court decision on Griswold v. Connecticut with the U.S. Supreme Court invoking the doctrine of right to privacy and substantive due process, said there was a constitutional right to access to contraception. This was a Connecticut law which prohibited or restricted the sale of contraception, but it was overturned and it was declared a right. And of course, the right to privacy was found in the emanations of the penumbras, right? That term. And of course, this has since been used to justify things. Of course, a few years later, with Roe v. Wade and abortion became of course, a substantive due process and a right to privacy. And also later on, that Lawrence versus Texas, where apparently it was unconstitutional to criminalize homosexuality. What we see now with the advocacy of transgenderism with children, the open grooming of children in schools, that perhaps it was unwise to declare homosexuality to be a constitutional right. And perhaps the criminalization of homosexuality, right, did not create a police state. It did at least inhibit or restrict the promotion of open homosexuality in places like public libraries and schools. But this was the year, of course, the court decided that there was a constitutional right under the doctrine of privacy to obtain contraception. Of course, immediately the government began promoting contraception. And this also coincides with the Great Society programs, because this became a part of government programs, both federal and state, to promote contraception under the guise of sex education. So again, assault on public morality, and also the assault on the meaning of sexuality, meaning this public policy was that sex could be separated from procreation, and this became instantiated in policy. And of course, the baleful effects of society that we've seen, of course, with declining birth rates and the aging population. So again, this was a landmark decision based on the imagination of a few liberal justices.
Yeah, and just to segue, '65 is also kind of when pornography came out of the closet. You'd had Playboy earlier, but you really started getting more graphic representations. It was all part of the free love,
Well,
you know.
also that's when the pawnbroker came to the movie theaters and broke the production code. Yeah,
Yeah, and
May
so
65. Yeah.
65 was really a turning point in terms of pornography. All of the cultural elements, the music, video, pornography, and of course, obviously the political attack on the inner city. They're all there at the same time. They're different components of a plan. This is the thing that is so hard for people to get their head around, is that because it's incremental and it occurs slowly, right? The changes occur slowly. People tend to not try to organize their minds to understand it as a structure or a plan, but it's obviously a plan. There's just no question. If you look at it through time and look at the kind of same intellectual DNA that's going from one group to another, one social movement to another, one political moment to another, this is an organized destruction of European culture. And it goes, you can see it at different points. It becomes visible. I refer to the Hungarian Soviet because it's so clear cut. The letters exist. You can read them and see that they were actually trying to do this. It's well known, and of course, it's because this led to the Frankfurt School, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is that you're not going to get a citation as to, well, here's the group. They're having they're talking about it. Stuff. This is all kept secret, and because of that, and because they proceed incrementally, the European is not alert to what is actually happening to him right now. And I am horrified by the fact that they're bringing back the mask mandates. They have what's being called the election variant, of the new COVID death fear. But immediately and inappropriately, in terms of any kind of health criteria, a lot of universities brought out the ma re restarted the mask mandates. And I think this probably, I hate to say it, but could be a trend. And we could be looking at another, mask and vaccine
Well, this is
mandate.
despite the fact that we all for the past year we've heard all these releases how masks didn't work. Of course,
Of
we knew at
course.
the time, but then there's this post-pandemic, it was a bad idea. But then why are you bringing it back again? And of course, if you want to wear a mask, go ahead and wear a mask. Same way, if you want to get a shot, go get a shot. Never explain why two parties have to wear a mask. If
Right.
you feel safe wearing a mask, put a mask on. I prefer to breathe,
Right.
so
Yeah. So
it's like, again, it's just stupidity. It's idiocracy. I was, like I said, I was watching Idiocracy on YouTube the other day, and I was like, it didn't come across as a comedy. It came across as a documentary.
well, it is a documentary. That's really, the kind of coherent smiling European culture is vanishing in America, and what's replacing it is barbarism and the clown world. Where is, you look at like Chicago, is that really a future that people would want to promote?
Oh yeah, well, that's what they want. They
Where
want,
is the where is the fruits of all of these projects that they can point to and say, look, continue to let us have the political power, and we're going to, take you to the brave new world. Everywhere, it's been a catastrophe. Every single example of them having political power has ended up with something like Chicago, where 50 years ago it was a great city, and now it is literally barbarism.
Well,
San
so.
Francisco collapsed within 5 years. So these things can easily happen everywhere, and I'm afraid they're going to start moving out into the suburbs unless we start to find that political mojo to be able to organize and find a way to resist,
In 1965 also featured final, I guess, convening of the Second Vatican Council. And it produced one of the later documents it produced was Nostra Aetate, which means in our time in Latin, but it was the Declaration on the Relation of the Church with Non-Christian Religions, the official declaration. It is an official declaration of the Second Vatican Council. It was passed in October 1965 by Pope Paul VI. It is the shortest of the 16 final documents of the Council. It comes out and says the Catholic Church. It was primary, although it deals with other religions, its primary focus was the Church's relationship to the Jews, with the Jews. And this was the Nostra Aetate itself, the report or the document, came out after I think the approach by Jules Isaac, a French-born Jew, who was associated with the Salzburg Conference of International Council of Christians and Jews, which he claimed made the rather, I think, the unfair claim that Christian anti-Semitism had culminated in the Holocaust. So we have the Holocaust narrative again. So Christianity, particularly Catholicism, bore some guilt for the Holocaust that had allegedly occurred during the Second World War. He was received sympathetically by John the 23rd. He was a predecessor to Paul the Sixth, and who endorsed the creation of the document. It came out and condemned anti-Semitism. The only problem was is the Nostra Aetate didn't define anti-Semitism, and anti-Semitism, as we know, has come to mean any criticism of Jews. And so the problem is, are Jews, are Jewish organizations, a Jewish power, is it a worthy or a deserving target or of criticism? Of course it is. Any human institution is, but it became sort of considered anti-Semitic just to criticize Jews or to call them out for their abuse of power, or the exercise of power, or the power that they have. Is it inordinate? Is it because of their scheming or nepotism and these things? These are legitimate criticisms or critiques, if you will. Ironic, coming from a group which loves to critique everyone else. Apparently, you critique them. It's anti-Semitism. This is particularly pro this is again, the document was promoted by B'nai B'rith, the American Jewish Committee, the World Jewish Congress, and so this document came out in October '65, and it created a problem because at the very time the church is condemning so-called anti-Semitism, the church is also considering various other documents on morality of the media, and the church is condemning the influence of cinema and Hollywood and psychoanalysis and advertising and modern media. And the only problem is the church criticizes the effects of morality on that, meaning particularly Americanism. The church was concerned not only just with the Soviet Union, but also with the United States itself and the West and sort of capitalism and Americanism itself and its corrupting influence, particularly on the faithful in Europe at the time, particularly in Italy at the time. The effect of American culture, post-war environment, and corrupting of those cultures, or those Catholic cultures. And of course, the promulgation of Nostra Aetate weakened the church's ability to respond to the moral crisis that was afflicting the West, because the primary agent promoting immorality in the West were Jews, whether it's Hollywood or advertising, psychoanalysis and these things. So if the church is obsessed with anti-Semitism or criticizing anti-Semitism, the church herself must engage in anti-Semitism as understood in order to fight these moral battles to protect the moral order. And so this had a very, because this created what they call Jewish Catholic Jewish dialogue, which is more or less a monologue. And so it's been a disaster for the Catholic Church and also for society in general, because it blunted the Catholic Church's ability to respond to the Jewish assault on public morality in cinema, in media, in the sciences and the universities at the time.
Yeah, it was just ridiculous. I mean, the church rightfully understood that psychoanalysis and pornography were both degenerate intellectual structures, right? You had to keep kids and even adults away from this thing, but then you can't be critical of Jews.
Who are
Well,
promoting it? Yeah, the primary force promoting
I'm
it.
sorry, but a little hard to like
Yeah.
criticize pornography and psychoanalysis without occasionally coming across a Jew. So it was ridiculous, and it couldn't have been a serious, I mean, a authentic response. I mean, what I mean is that I think the College of Cardinals was taken over by Masons, a while ago,
Well, there is some suggestion with Cardinal B. He was German, of course, and having a German cardinal deal with a Jewish matter, particularly in 1960, this is only 20 years after the war, And so psychologically, a German cardinal might not be predisposed to deal forcefully with the Jews for obvious because of all because of the narrative.
actually, when they, the current Pope with the Masonic, background. I mean, I think it's sort of out open now. They've been trying to find a way to get into the Catholic kind of political structure for hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, look at the Jesuits. Look at the origin of the Jesuits, where the Pope had to actually call out the organization, as a converso, hidden Jewish, political operative. And that, I think, is the one time when it was exposed, but it wasn't the only time they were trying this. Right. It would have been particularly, last half of the Middle Ages, they would have been focused on that like a laser. So they got in there, in my opinion, and the Catholic Church has has suffered, and it is misguided because of that. And that's why, during the pandemic, I was so aggressive about trying to get Vigano, who struck me as a righteous, I don't think he's a cardinal, but he was a bishop. To simply declare a schism. The rest of the Catholic political class, which is one way to characterize, the College of Cardinals, obviously, is polluted. They're Masonic. You can't have real Catholicism with these guys in charge, So just cut it loose and just try, he should have just cut them loose, declared a schism, and just taken his lumps. Whatever would have followed him would have been legitimate Catholicism, but the rest of what would have been left behind was useless,
Now, he probably sees it as he's better off fighting it from within,
Yeah, of
because
course, but I think he doesn't really understand just how corrupt and how and again, it goes to the idea of the lifetime actor. That expression is necessary for analysis of our world. If you don't have it, you end up in just endless, kind of
well,
complications.
yeah, apparently James Martin, who heads the American Jesuits, is like in has the ear of the current Pope, is it we can see. And of course the it's but the current Pope is a Jesuit, which I always thought that you're not supposed to be Jesuits weren't supposed to be Pope when they
Well,
was
how did this
created
happen?
their
Yeah,
specific mission,
and of course, there's all these suspicions that he's actually a Mason as well. They don't need to be members of the secret society. They can bring them up in other ways, and other kinds of control. We've looked at the blackmail approach that they can
Well, the
use.
Vatican Council, Second Vatican Council, was infiltrated by all by multiple intelligence agencies and connected agents. The CIA, John Courtney Murray, who was very critical, I mean, was very pivotal or played a critical role in promoting Americanism within the Catholic Church. He was an agent of Henry Luce. And then you also have B'nai B'rith, who had actually in their lobbying to direct or influence the Nostra Aetate. Nostra Aetate, it says, basically it doesn't basically they tried to get the church to say the Jews weren't responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, and the document came out and said that not all Jews were responsible, which is self-evident.
Right.
But nevertheless, it was interpreted as saying that that apparently they weren't collectively responsible for the cruise, which is not true, of course, based on the Gospels. But there was Malachi Martin, reportedly, who was the Irish priest who was doing the work of B'nai B'rith to get them to try to change the course of that document, and he was rewarded with a very lucrative publish. He eventually left the priesthood, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, remember, like you had the situations where you have the Freemasons in Italy, with the Vatican Bank.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's all about the deep state. That's that
I
infiltration
mean,
organized crime.
that is just as, it's absolutely as clear as a bell. I mean, the Vatican is simply part of this whole
And that's
apparatus.
part of the Cold War. And the Vatican is cornered into this because they're caught between the American Empire and the Soviet Union. And of course, I can forgive them for seeing the West as being more benign at the time, but it turns out it's much more dangerous to the Catholic faith than communism ever was. But of course, looking back at it, but the Vatican Bank's infiltrated with that because of that's involved in all types of intelligence operations and funding operations in Europe, particularly the P2 and also the Operation Gladio, which was the false flag terrorist operations
I mean,
occurring.
this to me just indicates that the corruption is goes all the way inside. And I mean, yeah, there's different ways of understanding, and I don't have a citation. It's not like, I talk to someone who can say, that's right, I'm a Freemason and a converso, and I'm inside the Vatican Bank running things. I mean, I don't know that. I can only approach these things analytically, but it sure seems logical to me that, given all of these facts, that the Vatican Bank was controlled by P2 Lodge, or had some influence in back and forth of the thing. And so, when you get to our current moment, again, it just I think of resegregation, and I think of Vigano. It needs to resegregate in the sense of, a schism. Just has to get rid of all of the dead weight, to use an expression, and try to create something that's actually can defend itself. And this all funny, it all kind of goes back to 65. I mean, 65, Tim, I was in Catholic school, Catholic high school. And I can tell you, it was just a different sort of, ethos
Well,
that
there
was.
was something that was during the who was the Supreme Court justice? Remember they got his yearbook and claimed that he fondled a girl at a party?
Oh, yeah, that guy, right.
What was it? What just said again? Was his name?
I mean, it'll come to me in a second.
Not Gorsuch. The other guy. He is Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh.
Kavanaugh, right.
And so we were treated to apparently some of the naughty things people wrote in his yearbook. It's like we hate people to read my yearbook because people wrote my high school yearbook.
Well, I mean,
But
I mean,
apparently
I graduated in 67 from Palisades High School, which is just ground zero for the destructive counterculture, and everything. Everyone who was writing in my yearbook, most of them were on LSD. The kids,
geez, yeah,
half
not fat.
the kids were on LSD. I mean, it was just the culture just collapsed,
Well, that's
you know.
what I was talking about with Kavanaugh. Is one of the things during the hearings was we got a glimpse of high school life in the early 80s in America, something that I experienced, of course. And it was, it was like, what's the Tom Cruise movie? Where he's
Fast Times at Ridgemont High,
no,
or what
well,
is
that's one of them, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, of course, 1981, 82. But you also have the Tom Cruise movie where he's running a prostitution operation out of his parents' house.
I know.
And he wants to go to Harvard, I think, or Yale or something. Yeah. E. Michael Jones was commenting on some of the details of Kavanaugh's high school party life. And he was saying how different, and he Kavanaugh, of course, was going to a Catholic high school. And he was saying how he had gone 20 years prior, he had gone to high school, how life was completely different. I mean, it's just the kids behaved much more morally. They weren't as reckless. They weren't getting drunk all the time, and it wasn't all about sex and everything. And of course, they were young and teenager, and eager. But everything was more restrained, particularly the females, meaning that you wouldn't have girls getting drunk and not knowing where they are, like this one lady did claim. Yeah, and he was
Well, I
just
mean,
saying
that's why
what a change it was from 1960. He graduated, I think, 1966. So he was in high school 62 to through 66. What different it was going to a Catholic high school in the early 60s than in the early 80s. And that's that cultural revolution that we're talking about that occurred, that kicked off in
absolutely. And that's why
65.
65 is so critical to understand, because if you look at what it was the most critical transition year. And you can see that in before it, you have one culture, and then after it, you're very rapidly moving to a whole different one.
I mean,
And it's
people just don't think that. I mean, that younger people actually behave differently.
right. Or that my generation somehow had the idea, like, gee, let's like tuck LSD and listen to psychedelic music. I mean, this was not an idea we had in 1965. So these ideas came from somewhere else, It's obvious that they were, created, inserted, and then promoted, and the fire was, blown into a raging forest fire that just swept across my generation, and has never, really been put out. I mean, it's just, so that was
Well,
1965.
Covering all of this, of course, 1965 is the United States. Lyndon Johnson escalates the Vietnam War and turns into a full-scale military operation for the United States in 1965.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, this
That's
is
part of
just,
it too. That was absolutely part of it, and it's part of the destruction of the baby boom
This
culture.
is when you get Operation Rolling Thunder, and the excuse was, of course, the instability of the propped-up government in South Vietnam necessitates a full-scale military commitment by the United States from 65, and this persists up until I guess 1971, 72, really. And then Nixon comes in 68 with a secret plan. And of course, nothing happens between 68. Finally, withdrawals in 1973, but he began, the Vietnamization of the war and the gradual pulling out of troops. It peaked, I think, in 1968 and started petering
Yeah.
out in 69, 70. And of course, the war became the impetus for a lot of the riots, the student protests, of course, this is the military draft and these things. So this is what's going on with the entire scene, and this sort of creates the generational divide and the culture rift in the country, and also the financial problems of the country, because that created the fiscal problems and the closing of the gold winter in 1971,
Yeah.
and you simply wouldn't have had the culture tumult of the 60s, at least not nowhere as intense as if he didn't have the Vietnam War,
Yeah, the war
which
protests are part of the bifurcation of culture. The young versus the old, the long hairs versus the straight, the drug takers versus the sober. I mean, it was really important. You had to have been seeing them, but they were really like rock concerts in a way. Everyone was very hip, lots of drugs, and the attitude of, our generation is somehow, different, and we need to change our culture.
Yeah, then you guys discovered sex, right?
Yeah, we did.
No one else
Yeah.
ever knew about it prior to you.
No, we were born all, it was a gigantic, immaculate conception of the baby boomer.
Although there was the baby boom, which implies there was a lot of sex going on, that it wasn't that wasn't that a rock festival in the
But
mud
what
scene.
was different is that I think the sex before had the context of relationship.
Well, yeah, you had families, large
But here
families, yeah.
but you see, that's why they had the idea of free love. That's why the expression free love, meaning non kind of relationship based sex. I mean, that's what free love
Yeah,
was.
I mean, that idea persisted sort of, well, the 60s as a sort of Dionysian excess. We see that, of course, with the music, obviously rock and roll, cacophonous rock music, and these things and sex and the cult of youth. Of course, this happens. This also speaks to sort of the demographics of the country, this huge young cohort. So it's going to matter more, right? It's going to be youth and sex and being a sexual attraction is going to matter more because there's a huge population that's sort of in that season of life, if you will, right? So that's good. It's going to matter more, but it's going to be exploited more because with mass communication and disposable income, they can be marketed to, and the people, of course, as we alluded to, the people controlling advertisement in Hollywood are the types that want to exploit, I guess, the gullibility and eagerness of the youth who have a lot of money to spend.
Well, and the movies were really influential. I mean, you think about like Barbarella and our Easy Rider. You have this hookup sex and nudity, in the context of this is a cultural revolution. We're heading someplace good, someplace better. The hippies thought they were actually morally in some way superior. They thought that the prior generation, somehow had this kind of problem that they were going to resolve, when of course, if you look at this and from the broad stroke, I mean, it's just ridiculous. The hippies were just absolutely degenerate and intellectually insipid, whereas the World War II generation was really, they had just obviously better relationships, better marriages, better families, better self-sufficiency. They were just all around better. My generation was damaged and didn't know it.
But yeah, of course, this is the Vietnam War, and again, it goes the it began, of course, you could say with the year before in August when you had the Gulf of Tonkin incident, but it wasn't until 65 where it really escalated and people started being drafted in large numbers, and of course, the response to that, and it became sort of a quagmire. There was no really no way way for the U.S. to win that war, because you can really define victory. Other than just bomb the country to smithereens, right? You see, that's what they did.
Vietnam War is going to look like the glorious, like most coherent, perfect war in history compared to the Ukrainian War. This thing is just an absolute debacle. I mean, it's just a slaughterhouse. It's just a an excuse, a veneer for genocide. So
Well, that was 1965.
that was 65, Tim.
So, well, Joe, I think we
All right,
covered
brother. Well, that was that year, and we'll get them next week.
it. Take it easy.
Okay, bye-bye.